But at the same time, to maintain their differences among themselves, to distinguish themselves from other parties, and perhaps to provide some kind of coherence in their own thinking, it was necessary to keep repeating that they adhered to the revolutionary outlook.
And ultimately, people who adhered to the revolutionary outlook, like Henry Abiguna, was left it.
In fact, only yesterday, I happened to be with Robert Gunawardhan. And when I went to Robert's, I found some old comrades of the LSSP also there. Two of them were working class comrades. One was a driver who used to drive one of our cars in the underground period. And in fact, he was the person who drove the car from the jail.
What's his name?
Milton.
What does he do now?
No, he's completely without job. He has a big family and finds it difficult to maintain it. He's frustrated in politics. And the burden of his song yesterday was that we were the people who took revolution seriously. We believed that there was no road to transform society except through the revolution. We didn't believe in parliament. And to us, socialism meant the complete nationalization of the forces of production. Well, what has happened to us, the others have used us to promote themselves. Now, this may not be true, but I think this is a phenomenon that is not peculiar to the movement in Ceylon. In all movements, the genuine revolutionaries are generally the more religious-minded of the membership of revolutionary political parties, and therefore their attitudes are more rigid, they are less adaptable, and they find themselves fundamentalist in all their approaches. So they tend to be left behind in any kind of movement.
Not necessarily. Sometimes the fundamentalists take over and lead it to victory.
In the period of revolutionary struggle. Because they are the most devoted, the most militant, and those who are most able to make sacrifices.
Then why didn't a period of revolutionary struggle arise?
Because of the peculiar non-revolutionary situation in Ceylon, in my opinion. Then you have a non-revolutionary peasantry. The peasantry in Ceylon is landowning, and there is no landlordism as such, which makes the revolutionary struggle on the agenda, so to speak.
Well, there are quite a number of landlords, absent landlords, but I don't suppose they are
not in a
heavy.
Feudal sense. Huh? Not in a feudal sense. But there is, how do you call them, some kind of rent paying cultivator.
Or under.
Yes. Of course, the Andhra system is feudal, and it dates from the traditional past.
Yes, but it is not an oppressive form.
It's not an oppressive form of landlordism. It is an extractive form of landlordism.
In fact, perhaps the difficulty here is that we don't have capitalist agriculture.
Yes, but that is what the government is now attempting to promote. Though it is not correct to say that also. You have capitalist agriculture in a highly organized, modern form.
Oh, the plantation. No, but I mean
in the food-producing sector, you don't have.
So you think that this throwing himself into this parliamentary struggle affects the Delhi? But then, now, I suppose the fundamentalists tend to decry this, and maybe a fundamentalist writing this might speak about the greatness of Mao and his crowd, or Castro and their revolution, and how a movement nurtured in struggle and in guerrilla warfare in the mountains and Chinese ways proved itself capable of taking power, whereas here they didn't. Still, when one looks at the situation here, hasn't one to admit that I mean, impractical to have this sort of struggle?
I think so. Except in two eventualities. The first would be a situation in which this problem of the cultural contradiction within the working class has been solved. Namely that of the plantation workers forming the bulk of the working class and yet belonging to a minority racially and culturally, excluding themselves thereby from leadership of the political struggle, where that problem has been resolved. The second situation would be one in which the democratic liberties have disappeared and the people have been forced to violent forms of struggle in order to defend or regain their liberties.
Was there any chance of beginning such a struggle in the war years? Because you did have a certain amount of support among the state labor, then the CIC was not all that strong. Did you have much of a chance then?
I still think no, because of the cultural contradiction within the working class. I don't believe that that link up between the workers of Colombo and the plantation workers would have been so easy to achieve. And secondly, that if there had broken out a militant and widespread wave of struggle on the plantation, that the masses in the rest of Ceylon would have responded to.
And also perhaps the people were too busy making, I mean the Ceylonese people anyway, were too busy making money out of the war to...
Of course, was there, and as you know, the SSP took the road of calling for turning the imperialist war into civil war, and so on. It had hardly any impact on the mass situation as such.
Does that mean that in the pre-war era, you hadn't sought to build up card or support among the peasants?
I think yes, there was no understanding, I would say, of the peculiar form of the leadership of the peasantry by the working class that was necessary for a successful revolution in the eyes of Marxists. We did not see that the peasant in Ceylon would not rally to a revolutionary call by merely promising them, merely because we promised them the land. Because most of them had land already, however inadequate and poor and so on. They still were landowners. Now we believe that we did not have to organize the peasantry because you couldn't organize them. They were so atomized and backward and scattered and so on.
Or you thought on those lines?
Yes, we realized that it was not possible to organize the peasants in that way. Therefore, the leadership of the revolution by the working class would take the form of the workers through struggle action in the city, taking command of a situation in which the peasantry have risen by themselves. That was roughly the thinking that we had at that time.
The classical Bolshevik
yes, absolutely. It was perhaps apposite to a situation such as India, but it certainly was irrelevant, I think, in Ceylon's conditions. And none of us really studied the peculiar village situation in Bharatpur.
Going, leaving that track and going back to this traditionalism, is it possible to say that traditional slogans are being used in a very modern setting and that's today? And to question whether those who use the slogans are really believe them or just use them as a weapon in order to gain power?
Perhaps not all of those who use these slogans have dreams of power. take one of the, you know, the emotion charged words that are used, tuppai. Now, I find that the people who use this word tuppai come from two strata. The smaller number among them come from really westernized elements, like in Judas, a few lawyers whom I know, one or two university people even, who are themselves tuppai if the word has any meaning. But who use this word with a considerable amount of bitterness and feeling to characterize those among the English-speaking elite whom they disagree with or whom they don't like, or who are in positions of dominance, of prominence. The other section, and this is the majority who uses this word, come from people who, though they have been educated in English schools, cannot use the English language as satisfyingly as they can use a similar language. In other words, their background is more similar than English. Some of them are similar journalists, teachers, clerks, and so on. They are the type of English school product whom those of us who came from English, purely English-speaking homes, used to laugh at, coming from Ananda and places like that. These people also use this word to fight, to elevate themselves in their own regard, more or less.
So this is, this supports the contention that it largely stems from envy.
Yeah, from envy.
All right. Motivation, envy, and perhaps in some cases genuine protest. But isn't it a fact too that many people who use them are appealing to an electorate or appealing to the masses? A masses dominated by the fascists, who they feel are traditionalistic, who they feel are Buddhist oriented, and therefore who they think will be attracted by this threat.
Yes, I was not thinking of the politicians here. Certainly the politicians have done it. Philip, for instance, was one of those who started this whole business.
Yes.
And then the Buddhist priests, even those who came to the left, they have been using this word to fight, to denounce the whole tribe of English-speaking people. So they undoubtedly have decided to exploit some of the most backward feelings or sentiments of the masses.
In conjunction with this point, and 1956 in particular, I would like to raise one point. Now the theory goes that 56 signaled the defeat of this English-educated, Western-oriented class, the Western-oriented elite. And you found an emerging elite of rural petit bourgeois. Firstly, I was wondering whether this concept of English educated, English speaking elite is a sufficiently precise social category, because it includes people, clerks and capitalists and so on and so forth, Goigama caucus and those not within that ruling group. It contains so many disparate elements that I wonder whether it's an adequate term.
Yes, in fact it is dangerous to use this concept of elite in substitution of more adequate or the equally necessary concept of class. I think there were two separate processes here which many people have tended to equate and identify. The first is the actual dislodgement of the class in power. Now, it was not an elite class that was in power. It was a propertied class that was in power. And this propertied class, it is true, because they had access to Western education and could send their children and themselves to Western universities and universities abroad, they were able to bring to the work of government administration and education, and one might say the general business of society, culture of the West and the amenities which go side by side with contemporary Western culture. Now, the elite that was recruited to run the state and to man select positions in society did not come from their class alone. They came from all classes to the extent
that from even their class means property.
Yes, the property class. The elite, we had a considerable mobility in our society thanks to widespread education, free education later, and so on. And therefore, even the son of a poor class in an outstation town could with some difficulty go through university and pass into civil service or become a lawyer or a doctor and so on. And to that extent, he was able to rise to a very important place among the elite. But this did not mean that he became bourgeois. He became an instrument of the bourgeoisie. He became a supporter of the power of the bourgeoisie, of the property-owning class in society. Now, what happened in 1956 was firstly that the power of the class was undermined. I won't say that the property-owning class was pushed out of power. No. But its political power was very considerably undermined. It was diluted. And this process of dilution came about by an attempt on the part of the traditional elite to challenge the dominance of the modern or the Western elite. So, there were two separate processes.
Mm-hmm. All right, then concentrate on one process,
yes.
Challenge of the tradition. Challenge raised by the traditional elite,
yes. To the Westernized elite,
symbolized in what one might call, say, the defeat of the trouser Johnny by the Sarong Johnny.
Yes. Yes. The instrument of that challenge, and one might say of the transformation that was sought to be brought about, was the Sinhala language. They thought that by introducing Sinhala only overnight, down would fall the Westernized elite and the Vedamahatta and the school teacher and the Mudalai would be able to enthrone themselves in the places that the former occupied.
All right, but this blow led by the traditional elite and the Westernized elite included. Diluted the power of the property elite.
Yes.
But in giving this blow, they were also hitting at many of their own number in the sense that this Westernized elite included many who were missing from their own class.
Quite right. But, and this is the important part of this process, this antagonism between the traditional elite and the Westernized elite was a partial antagonism. In many ways it was phony. Because, in the first place, there was no point of contact between these traditional elements and the modern elements. The Vedamahatya, for instance, could not dream of driving the doctor out of the general hospital and installing himself there. He could only sort of denounce the system of Western medicine, run down the doctor because of his generally affluent way of life, and so on. And hope that by government patronage, he would be able to build himself up to the position which the allopathic doctor occupied. In other words, what he was looking forward to was not to break down the system of Western medicine, but to lever his own income situation upwards.
So it was partly economic movement.
It was an economic movement.
Right. So you get this economic movement using this traditionalistic weapon and aura and hitting at this modern westernized groups and trying to lever themselves up to equal status perhaps and equal, which meant economic and equal economic power. And in the process, undermining the property elements too. Can you say that? Because in many ways they were also property.
Yes, but how did they undermine the power of the property elements? In a direct way, by disputing their control over the state machine. And this was the more important part of it, by using the state against these property elements. In other words, trying to bring the property elements under the control of the state. One, by heaping tax burdens, controls of various kinds, on the property elements and thereby having more income in the hands of the state to use to level incomes upwards in society. Two, by the steps of nationalization. But of course here, they were not unanimous about it. The moment the masses began to press for using the state machine to knock the property elements on the head more or less by nationalization, those who had property among the traditional elements began to fight share.
My thinking is still a bit cloudy on this.
Yes.
But again, this group, this economic movement using the traditionalistic cry, may have undermined the property elements by using the state machine.
Yes.
But looking at it in another way, approaching another way, perhaps you could say that they undermined the old property groups, the top property layer, was undermined in the sense that a lower property layer, some small property group, now was asked to share the pie. In saying that it was now the property was being diffused among, especially into the economic benefit, were now being diffused among a wider group rather than among select group.
Yes, now I would say the best way to regard this is to look at it a little concretely.
We've been talking that.
The property classes consisted really of three broad sections. The first were the plantation owners. They were really the aristocracy of the property classes, because they combined also feudal notions of status through property owning with the bourgeois avenues of profit through running agriculture as commercial businesses. The second were the trading element, particularly those connected with import-export trade in Colombo. This had a lot of power in their hands because they were the indigenous elements among them, really were junior partners of the British firm who dominated the trade. And behind the British trailed the Indian trading elements, who had a considerable part of the trade in foodstuffs, textiles, and so on. The third element were the professional classes, who by really
serving
by the legal profession, the medical profession, and the civil service, who amassed wealth and invested it in various ways, and gradually found their way into the ranks of the property owners. Now, what did this element among the in the movement that was using traditional values to come to power, what did they seek? What were they seeking? One, they were looking for land which they could also cultivate on a fairly large scale. And they sought to get this land primarily in the new colonies that were being, the colonization areas that were being opened. And they sought to get the assistance of the state through the provision of irrigation facilities, electricity and so on, to enable them to develop the land. Now, they sought to get the patronage of the state to enrich themselves. So far as the trading element was concerned, their aspiration was to shut out the Indians first, because they were the easiest target, to shut them out of the benefits of state patronage, and to use the control over trade that the state had exercised for a considerable time, to channel this trade in their direction. So they wanted more licenses to Sinhalese and less to Indians and Britishers and so on and so on. The third, in regard to the professional classes, of course, they were realistic. They did not believe that with Sinhala they could climb to the top of the legal and medical professions. So they were only seeking to get the patronage of the state to uplift the village teacher and the Vedamatya and so on, and the village teacher and the Vedamatya, and thereby enable them also to share some of the benefits of state patronage. Now, if you look at it that way, then you will see how important state power was for these traditional classes. By themselves, they could not challenge the more modern property classes. Mm-hmm. They hope to use the state against them and thereby enrich themselves. Mm-hmm.
In these two processes, that's a very illuminating, but again approaching it from another angle, or shall I say concentrate on a particular point.
Yes.
You get this English-oriented, shall I say, more facile in English group,
yes,
which includes various layers, I would say,
yes,
from, apart from this, shall I say, these three groups at the top,
yes,
there were perhaps one would say, three groups at the top, the A group,
yes,
then B, and right at the lower level, C, the clerks, and now, the traditionalist group in using Sinhala language and Sinhalese culture and Buddhist religion against these elements,
yes,
was, in a sense, hitting at all three. But basically, I think the real struggle was between the A group and these groups, because I think the clerks and others were sort of left or in on sidelines more or less, because they, it was the A group who held state power, and what the traditionalistic group were doing were to try and get state power to raise their own economic position, and in fact those who came from it probably rose to a higher economic level than the C and B groups of the English-speaking elite.
Yes, only I would not like to think that these were two completely antagonistic strata.
The class
and the traditional elements and the modern elements.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially all of them belong to the ranks of the middle class. And there was a very considerable area in which they merged one into the other. Now, for instance, Maliban Mudalali sprang from the ranks of what you would disparagingly call the boutique keepers, or what it be, restaurant keepers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having accumulated money, he could give his daughter to a person who was in the external affairs ministry.
Yes, sir.